It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. The terror of Boko Haram with its abduction, its kidnapping of more than 200 schoolgirls in Nigeria, the ongoing killing and internal conflict in South Sudan, the trial of Oscar Pistorius, the Blade Runner. Many of us only experience what goes on in Africa through news reports, of course. And today, though, we want to devote the hour to a discussion that goes behind the headlines in Africa to get a better sense of some of the forces at work on that vast continent, to better understand some of the context in which the news out of Africa is happening. A little later in the hour, we'll meet some Iowans who are reaching out to help in a couple of different ways in Africa. But first, we've invited Peta Agbese with us in our studio, a native of Nigeria and professor of political science at the University of Northern Iowa. Professor Agbese, Peta, welcome.
Thank you, Ben.
And we want to reach out to our listeners this hour. Perhaps you have a question about Africa that takes us behind or beyond the headlines. We'd like you to join our discussion with your questions, your perhaps your experiences in Africa, or your observations. 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100. Our email, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. You can tweet us at IPR Talk, or find Iowa Public Radio on Facebook and leave a question or a comment. If we could, Peta, start first of all with what is in our headlines and has been for a few weeks, Nigeria, until the abduction of more than 200 girls at the government girls' secondary school there. Nigeria's Boko Haram insurgency received very little attention in our media. Only a brief attention was given when insurgents would explode bombs or torture school. However, this mass abduction has brought the world's attention to the violence that has become, we understand, it's routine in northern Nigeria over the past 3 years. Can you explain some of the context in which this kidnapping takes place?
Yeah, thank you, Ben. Yeah, it's really quite surprising the number of newspaper and other publications that have focused on Boko Haram in the last 3 weeks or so, particularly since the abduction of the schoolgirls. I checked and I think I found that there have been over 435 different U.S. publications that have had a story on the abduction. That's quite unusual. I don't even think that the 1994 genocide in Rwanda received that much coverage. But nonetheless, I think the abduction was such a horrific event, and also the power of Twitter made people more conscious about what happened. Boko Haram has been carrying out deadly assaults on Nigerians, particularly since 2009. The organization was first created in 2002 by a young Muslim cleric known as Mohammed Yusuf. But Boko Haram has actually operated in five different phases. In the first phase, that lasted from about 2002 until 2004, the organization concentrated on establishing its own schools and its own mosque in Maiduguri. Maiduguri is the largest city in the northeastern part of Nigeria. But the leadership of Boko Haram, which official name translated from Arabic to English means people committed to proselytization and jihad, clash with established Muslim clerics in the city of Maiduguri. Mm-hmm. And the group then withdrew into the rural areas. In fact, at this stage, it called itself the Nigerian Taliban because it fashioned itself, its organizational structure, after the Taliban in Afghanistan.
So Peta, its goal, its vision for Nigeria would be similar to the Taliban as well?
Yeah, very much so. Although some Nigerians ask, what does Boko Haram want? But I think they ask that question more out of frustration rather than not knowing what the group stands for.
Well, what do they want?
Boko Haram says it wants to establish, quote-unquote, a pure Islamic state in Nigeria, that it is committed to fighting against non-Islamic forms of government. It doesn't recognize the legitimacy of the Nigerian government. Neither does it recognize the legitimacy of the 1999 Nigerian constitution. And it says that anybody who doesn't accept its own version of Islam, it's an enemy that must be put to death or be forced to accept its own brand of Islam. Its goals are anathema to almost every Nigerian. I mean, if Boko Haram were to succeed at education, there will be summary execution of people who disagree with Boko Haram. There will be no economic development in the country. There will be no national unity in Nigeria because everybody will be forcibly converted to Islam. And so its goals are highly retrogressive. But even more so, the means by which it is trying to accomplish its goals, which is inordinate infliction of violence on people and on property, it's unacceptable to everybody in Nigeria.
Mm-hmm. If, by your description, Boko Haram does not enjoy any significant popular support, how can you exist? And why wouldn't the government stamp out the insurgency that enjoys evidently very little support?
Boko Haram does not have any popular support whatsoever. In places where it operates through fear and intimidation. Boko Haram has been able to exist in this form since 2009 because of the ineptitude of the Nigerian government. Even if we take the recent case of the abduction of the over 200 schoolgirls from Chibok, and Chibok is a place I know very well. I went to high school not too far from Chibok, and I have many classmates who came from Chibok. But the Nigerian government has been completely ineffectual in responding to Boko Haram. When the news of the abduction broke, there were indications that high officials of the Nigerian government, including the president and his wife, did not believe that the abduction had actually taken place. In fact, they thought it was a hoax. The president's wife even threatened that if after 3 days the girls were not released, she will march to the residence of the governor of the state where the girls were abducted from, demanding that the governor should release the girls. The governor was not the abductor of the girls. It was Boko Haram. In fact, the president, when he was at, he didn't say anything about Boko Haram for almost 21 days. And when he talked about Boko Haram, he said he didn't even know where the girls were, and he didn't even know who had taken the girls, when it was clearly evident that it was Boko Haram. And the following day, Abubakar Shekau, the leader of Boko Haram, in an apparent taunting of the president, announced that he and his group were responsible for the abduction. And so this idea that the abduction was a hoax prevented the Nigerian government from doing anything about it.
Mm-hmm.
But also, it shows lack of military intelligence on the part of the Nigerian government. Friday last week, Amnesty International released a report that Nigerian security forces were informed about the impending abduction 4 hours before it took place. And yet, there was no response from the Nigerian security services. Now, later on, the Nigerian government said, that when they received the information, they sent soldiers from Maiduguri. Maiduguri, it's about 130 kilometers away from Chibok at night to go and rescue the girls, and that the soldiers were ambushed along the way. Now, what type of ineptitude is this? Where the soldiers going on a mission will not anticipate that they will be ambushed by Boko Haram. Boko Haram anticipated that soldiers will come along the road, and they set up ambush and successfully frustrated the soldiers, if that's really what happened. And then we have to take into consideration the high level of corruption in the country, which has made it very difficult for the military to acquire the necessary weapons and technical equipment for confronting such a virulent insurgency. So if we look at it, it has also not been the priority of the government. The government is more, the president is more interested in running for re-election next year. In fact, a day after Boko Haram had detonated a bomb in Nyanya, which is a suburb of Abuja. Abuja is the capital city of Nigeria. The president went on a campaign rally, and he was singing and dancing at a rally when most Nigerians were shocked at the dastardly act.
Let's remind those who've just joined us that you are Peter Akpese, a native of Nigeria and a professor of political science at the University of Northern Iowa. We're talking with you about Nigeria and hopefully some other topics, news topics in Africa. I wonder, when we talk about the reaction in the last 3 weeks of the world, the press attention in North America and other parts of the world to the abduction of these more than 200 schoolgirls, has that changed anything? Will the government be mobilized to do something about this? What has all this attention done?
The attention has been wonderful in gingering the government to at least begin to pay attention to the plight of the schoolgirls. As I said, for 21 days, the president did not say anything about the abduction. It took ordinary Nigerians who began to protest, demanding that the government should do something. And this, fortunately, was picked up by the international community. And we have had so many people, including Michelle Obama, the wife of President Obama, who in the broadcast she made Saturday last week drew attention to the plight of the girls.
And then some parts of the political spectrum criticized her for that. What good, they said, does that do these girls in Nigeria?
It does a lot of good. It bolsters support for Nigerians who every day have been protesting against the abduction of the girls. Now, the Nigerian government, instead of concentrating on trying to find the girls or to fight against Boko Haram, it's instead fighting against the protesters. And without that international exposure of the situation in Nigeria, the government would have cracked down even more severely on the protesters. So the international attention has been very, very helpful, at least in exposing what is going on in Nigeria. It has turned a searchlight not just on the incompetence of the government, but also the high-level corruption that exist in the country. The Economist magazine, the New York Times have all written editorials about how incompetent and how corrupt and how clueless the government headed by President Jonathan of Nigeria is.
Let's talk a little bit about what you help the U.S. and the Western powers have offered will do here. The U.S. and Western powers have stepped up some military assistance to the Nigerian government. Has the Nigerian government been able to accept that or found it easy to accept that assistance? And what do you think that assistance will do?
Well, Nigerians, many of them actually had a misconception about the nature of the international assistance. When the U.S. announced that it was going to provide assistance to the Nigerian government to help rescue the girls, most people in Nigeria thought that the Americans were coming to join the fight against Boko Haram. In fact, I had some friends in Nigeria who called me excitedly talking about how American soldiers were coming to root out Boko Haram. The help, it's quite appreciated, but I think most of it will come in terms of both military intelligence and also surveillance from the air, particularly to find where the girls are. And once the location of the abducted girls has been found, then options on how to rescue them will be put in place. But the fact that Nigerians now know that they are not alone dealing with a clueless government has been quite important in boosting the morale of Nigerians in general.
Could this mean the ouster of President Goodluck Jonathan?
It may not mean that, but there is a lot of disquiet even within the armed forces. Just yesterday, there was a report of a mutiny among the soldiers in Maiduguri. Maiduguri is the hotbed of the Boko Haram insurgency. And that some soldiers were so angry against their commander. One of the things the Nigerian government did in response to Boko Haram was to establish a new division, the 7th Division of the Nigerian military, to fight against Boko Haram. And yesterday, some soldiers tried to kill the commander of this division in frustration against the ineptitude of the military in dealing with Boko Haram. So it may not lead to the ouster of Jonathan, but the fact that the military is also frustrated in its fight against the Boko Haram may increase tensions between the military and civilians. So in other words, it may worsen civil-military relations in Nigeria, even if the position of President Jonathan is not threatened by Boko Haram. But I think it will make it very difficult for him to win re-election next year because security is the most important issue in Nigeria. The government doesn't have any viable option on how to deal with Boko Haram. In fact, as I'm speaking to you, the Nigerian government, after fighting Boko Haram since 2009, does not even have an anti-terrorism strategy. There is an anti-terrorism law that was passed in 2011 and was amended last year. But there is no overall strategy on how to combat Boko Haram.
If you've just joined us, Peter Peter Agbese is a native of Nigeria and political science at the University of Northern Iowa, joining us this hour to look beyond and behind Africa. If you'd like to join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org. We're also on Facebook, or you can tweet us at IPR Talk. And broadening the conversation, we have an email from one of our listeners, Tom, who writes, "Why does Africa seem to be the only place in the world where the West is seeming to be continuously intervening or engaged to, in most cases, just to avoid some human catastrophe? Is it the people, the environment, a legacy of colonialism, all three, or a complex combination, or none of the above?" asks Tom.
Very good observation by Tom. There are a number of factors. Tom highlighted a few of them. The legacies of colonial rule cannot but be highlighted as some of the difficulties confronting African governments. Now, a number of African countries celebrated their 50th anniversary of independence from colonial rule. I know 50 years may not be long enough to address many outstanding issues inherited from colonial rule. But the impact of colonialism on Africa is still quite evident. But I think more importantly, the failure of leadership in Africa is a major factor responsible for many of the needless humanitarian crises that are created in many parts of Africa. If we take the case of Nigeria, for instance, I pointed out that inept leadership is largely responsible for the success of Boko Haram. At best, Boko Haram fighters do not number more than a few thousand. In fact, one estimate is that there are no more than 3,000 fighters in Boko Haram. The Nigerian Armed Forces, they have about 75,000 men in the Nigerian Armed Forces. So how can we have a situation where a force of 75,000 soldiers cannot successfully deal with Boko Haram that has just 3,000 fighters? But poor leadership is one of the major problems afflicting Africa. With poor leadership comes corruption, comes unaccountable government, comes rigging of elections, comes the manipulation of ethnic, religious, and other primordial identities. And when those things happen, then crisis ensue. And when the crisis ensues, the governments in Africa are unable to deal with those crises, and they go cap in hand, begging for international support.
Can you point to instances in Africa where there is very good leadership?
Oh, yeah. Most political scientists who study governance in Africa tend to cite the case of Botswana as an exceptionally well-governed country in Africa. But there is really nothing that Botswana is doing that cannot be replicated among the other 53 African countries. One of the best things that Botswana has done, Botswana depends, like many African countries, on minerals, in the case of Botswana, on diamonds. It also has a lot of agricultural production. The government was committed to transparency, and therefore the resources from diamonds were used not for private enrichment by the rulers, but for bettering the lives of ordinary people. And it's not surprising that Botswana has had the second longest continuous democratic government in Africa. The first is Senegal. Senegal has also been doing very well. In fact, of the 15 countries in West Africa, Senegal is the only country that has not had a military coup and therefore no military rule. And so it is not a secret that good leadership can resolve many of the problems mm-hmm. in Africa, and so, Africa doesn't need to ask for help.
If you say a real major problem is failure of leadership, and you point to some exceptions to that among Africa's 53 countries, what is at the root of the problem that the majority have a failure of leadership or weak leadership? Is it the culture? Is it structures just not existing? What is going on?
Part of the problem is the philosophy of governance. In many African countries, the philosophy of governance is that those in power use governmental positions for private enrichment. In other words, they see their governmental positions not to serve the people, but to use the resources for their own private wealth accumulation. And so you have situations where countries are rich, but the citizens are poor. And not only that, the leadership becomes very insensitive to the plight of ordinary people. Just recently, the Nigerian president was asked to comment on the revelation that Nigeria, China, India, and a few other countries have the highest concentration of poor people in the world. And President Jonathan's response is that Nigeria is not a poor country because, after all, Nigeria ranks among the 10 largest countries in the world with private aircraft. Now, how could that be a measure of people's welfare? If you have a country of 160 to 170 million people in Nigeria, and even if 1 million of these have private aircraft, what does that say about the fact that most people in the country are mired in poverty?
Sounds like it could be a leftover attitude from colonialism.
There is a limit to which we can blame colonialism. And I'll be the first to argue that colonialism did a lot of damage to Africa. But I think sometimes African leaders use the legacies of colonialism as a cop-out.
Okay, we have to take a short break. With us is Peter Akbese. He is a native of Nigeria and a professor of political science at the University of Northern Iowa. We're looking at Africa beyond and behind the headlines. You can join our conversation 1-866-780-9100 with your questions, your experiences, your observations. RiverToRiver@iowapublicradio.org is our email. Iowa Public Radio is also on Facebook. Also, when we come back, we'll meet some Iowans who are reaching out to help in a couple different ways in Africa. That's when we return. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Glad to have you with us on this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. With us this hour, Peter Akbese is a professor of political science at the University of Northern Iowa, also a native of Nigeria. We're trying to look beyond the headlines that we see coming out of Africa and discuss some of the political situations in Africa. If you'd like to join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. And we want to have a couple of other guests join us now. First of all, Moses Bomet is the founder and president of Hope for Africa. Moses founded the group while he was a student at Des Moines Valley High School. He's a graduate of Iowa State University, currently a grad student at Drake University. Moses, welcome to our program.
Thank you.
You are now in your early 20s, I understand. You were born in the United States, but your family returned to Kenya, where it has its origins. Tell us the story of the founding of this organization and how your return to Kenya fit in there.
Yes, I was born in the United States, as you mentioned, but I grew up in Kenya for 12 years before coming back in 2006. And when I came back, most of my life back in Kenya was spent, of course, in school. And so first thing when I came to the United States, I just started seeing all the opportunities that were here. They call it the land of opportunity, and truly it is the land of opportunity. And I started seeing life from a different perspective, seeing the opportunities that were here and starting to ask myself, why are there not the same opportunities back in Kenya when I was growing up?
Educational opportunities.
Exactly. And so after that, I started to see what are the problems that are facing Africa, and some of the problems were identified in the earlier segment, and seeing the poverty, you know, diseases, the crime, the war, and the insecurity. And from my research and from my understanding, I came to see education as the missing link, the root cause being ignorance, a lack of knowledge, and started to ask myself, what can I do? What can I do to help out? And it started out as a small club, a high school club in Valley High School, West Des Moines, Iowa. And in the last 6 years, it's grown to several universities in the state of Iowa and outside the state of Iowa, investing over $55,000 at partner schools. In Kenya, we work with six schools that we've provided books, computers, musical instruments, you know, all sorts of things that are helping improve the quality of education.
Mm-hmm. And what difference can you tell this has made in Kenya?
It was actually last year. I go every year. Actually, tomorrow I'll be on the plane going back to Kenya for 2 weeks. And last year when I went there, we started collecting some data, looking at how our schools compare to other schools, looking at enrollment, looking at test scores, looking at the students going on to further their education. And we started seeing a trend, and we could see that our schools, I mean, in some cases, almost doubled in enrollment just from what we had done in the last 5 years. And looking at the test scores improve, you know, they were topping their divisions, topping their districts. And the biggest thing that it's hard to capture in numbers, in statistics, but it's just the motivation, you know, knowing that other people are coming to help you be independent, to help you become what you want to become, is really what has moved some of the students in the schools.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting that you have this contrast between Kenya and the education here. You notice the opportunity when you return from Kenya here in the United States. Do you think that we, very many of us, take the education opportunities we have here in the U.S. for granted, that we don't appreciate them as much as we should?
It is. I've seen it. I've experienced it when I was in high school, and I even fell into it, you know, sometimes, and I have to remind myself really that we're truly blessed with what we have here in the United States. But you know what I see is people just don't know. And my experience with Hope for Africa has been that a lot of people want to support things like this, help other people, work with other people. It's just the missed opportunity, and the people who have shared my story, told them what we're doing, they join us, they get behind us. And so I think a lot of Americans just haven't had the opportunity to be educated on the situations abroad.
Moses, you said you're leaving tomorrow for Kenya?
Yes, that's correct.
What is your goal for this visit?
I will be going back with six other people from here in the United States, and we'll be going to visit our six schools and a few other new schools we're going to be visiting. Will be our biggest program we're doing is we're adding additional teachers to the classrooms. We've seen that you're talking ratios of about one teacher to 43 students. In the United States, on average, is about one to 20-something. So almost double the classroom sizes in these schools. And so we want to add additional teachers, and we've been raising a lot of funds over the year, and we'll be putting that in place alongside updating our computer labs, providing more books.
Over $50,000, you said, has been raised. Are there particular ways you, besides asking for donations, that you raise money?
Actually, majority of that has come from young people. That's what our organization prides itself. And so we have clubs in different colleges, Iowa State, University of Iowa, University of Missouri, a few other places, where students organize these fun events. You know, we don't want to be seen as an organization that just wants, you know, we want money, we want money, we want money. No, we find creative ways to fundraise, whether it's selling T-shirts, whether it's, selling you know, African artifacts from Africa, just all sorts of things where people can feel it's something fun they're doing, but at the same time making a difference.
Moses Bomet, founder and president of Hope for Africa, stay with us. We want to meet a couple of other Iowans here who are engaged in Africa. Jay Norton is an associate professor of soil fertility and University of Wyoming extension specialist. He is here with us by phone, along with his father, Jim Norton, a retired engineer and developer of a multifunction farm implement. Jay and Jim, welcome to our program.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Let's start off with Jay, the son here. This, as I understand, this story starts with you working with graduate students from Africa. Tell us the story.
Yes. I We had two PhD students from Kenya working here, and we came across a call for proposals from USAID through a program called a CRISP. It's a collaborative research support program that where they seek to involve U.S. universities with Kenyan universities and African universities and non-governmental organizations. And both of these PhD students, Emmanuel Mondi and Eusebius Mukwana, were founding directors of NGOs, non-governmental organizations in Kenya. And so, you know, once we saw this call for proposals, there was no choice but to submit, and we ended up getting this project. So it's a big involved project, and we've had three additional graduate students come from Kenya for degrees here.
We're running short of time. It has to do with the soil. What is it about the soil that you wanted to, the challenge that you faced there?
Yeah, building soil organic matter and soil quality for sustainable intensification of crop production. And there were really no tools other than the old-fashioned moldboard plow pulled by oxen. So that's what I started talking to my dad about, was they need some alternative tools that don't turn the soil over, that leave residues on the surface, and that maybe, you know, need less power so they can be pulled by donkeys.
Okay, Jim, this is where you come in, Jay's father. You designed a plow that had what specifications to take to the farmers in Kenya and Uganda?
Well, it started out being just like a chisel plow to break this hard pan that's been created over the years. We built a prototype of that and tried it here on Iowa soil. And then after going to Kenya and Uganda and visiting with the folks over there, we could see other needs that this machine might be able to accommodate. So come back and redesigned it to be more of a moldable use tool.
What other needs?
Oh, like cultivating, weeding, cultivating row crops and just weeding barren fields to get a start on your planting.
And this is not pulled by oxen?
No, donkeys can handle it real easily. And as far as the people, women and younger children can use it. It's on wheels, and that makes all the difference in the world.
Why is it better that a donkey can pull it, a smaller animal, obviously, than an oxen? But why is that better for the people to use
it?
Well,
there's a lot more donkeys around, and they're easier to come by, and they're easier to take care of. Oxens are require more food, more feed, and they're just less of them.
Mm-hmm. Jay, going back to you, what have you found to be your biggest challenges in this development, using this money to help out?
Well, we're trying to implement what we call conservation agriculture, which involves minimized disturbance of the soil, and that's where this implement comes in. It also involves maintaining crop residues on the soils, and that's a big challenge because crop residues are valuable for lots of things, including animal feed and building materials and fuel for cooking. So it's hard to convince people to kind of leave residues on the soil surface and to plant things like cover crops that, you know, feed the soil, but they don't get any direct return on their table from that effort. So those are constraints that we have. And then just having the animals available to pull these things, like Dad was saying, oxen are more expensive to keep. They're also worth more. So we'd find that a farmer that had an oxen one year, you know, by the time we got there next year, he sold it because he needed the money. So donkeys are much easier to train and handle, and they pretty much take care of themselves. So that's a big advantage of this thing.
How many of these implements are now at being used in, I understand, Kenya and Uganda? What's their future, too?
Well, we have four of them in those two countries, and they're being shared by a number of farmers that we're working with. And then there's one in Zimbabwe and one in Ghana. And we're about to ship materials to Ghana for 10 of them that can be assembled there. And so, you know, as far as the future, we'd really like to identify a manufacturer in one of those countries, or maybe each of those countries, that could start to build these things. And then we could, you know, start to understand the cost. And that's going to be another constraint. But we're hoping we can work with some microcredit organizations to get these in farmers' hands that can share them, you know, in neighborhoods and things like that.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News, talking about the politics of Africa, also some stories behind the scenes in Africa involving those of us here in the Midwest. We have an email from Libby. I think I'll pitch this one over to Pita Agbese, our professor of political science at the University of Northern Iowa. Libby writes in an email, as a native Iowan currently working for an NGO in Liberia, I am curious to know what you would consider to be the best and worst consequences of foreign aid in West Africa.
Yeah. Thank you, Libby. The best is that it provides hope. If foreign aid is used to augment or supplement local effort, it becomes very useful. On the other hand, the drawback is that it tends to create an aid dependency in which people think that the solution to their economic problems lie with foreigners as providing them economic aid. But if it is used judiciously, particularly if you don't just dump aid on a community.
What does that mean, used judiciously? How?
Okay. Like what Jim and Jay are doing, the first identify a problem in agricultural production. Then they came here and designed a solution to it in terms of what they have just described. Now, when you provide something like that to people in Africa, they can then use it, put it to productive use. On the other hand, where you simply send money and you don't even monitor how the money is spent, it is often misused. Or you simply send antiquated products because you think Africans are so poor that no matter how useless a commodity is in the United States, Africans will eagerly embrace it, then that's not really very useful.
Mm-hmm. Moses, a related question to you. Moses Bomet, founder and president of Hope for Africa. Do you see evidence of foreign aid in schools where you're active?
I've seen actually one of the schools we went to is supported by World Vision, which is a big, big charity that, you know, works with different governments and receives support outside. And I've seen some of that be put in place. The other way that we've seen is through government support. Unfortunately, the issues that we see is when this funding, you could hear from United States saying, hey, we sent $5 million. It gets divided among so many schools in Africa that by the time it reaches some of these rural schools, it is doesn't make that big impact, doesn't zero in as much as it needs. So we try to ensure our resources are focused a little bit more so we can actually see the results as instead of just dividing it out there so everyone gets a small piece of the pie.
Mary joins us from Iowa City. Hi, Mary, coming to the end of our program, but what did you want to pitch into this hour?
Well, I wanted to pitch in. The professor was talking about governance in Africa, and I wanted to ask him what affected the Cold War have on the governance of Africa, along with the death of Patrice Lumumba and George Shultz during the Reagan administration, so that what we have left in African leaders, to me, is just, you know, what was left, the worst of the worst, were allowed to survive and rule those countries.
Mm-hmm. Okay, because I think you're getting at, Mary, that this country supported anybody who was not a communist. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, that's what I'm saying.
Okay, Peter.
Horrible African leaders like Mobutu Sese Seko of the then Zaire, now Democratic Republic of the Congo, Samuel Doe of Liberia, and many other atrocious African dictators were supported during the Cold War, both by the United States and the Soviet Union. But more egregiously was that the United States supported some of the most horrible African leaders, even some who aspired to leadership, like Jonas Savimbi of Angola. So there was no question that For Americans, the Cold War was a cold war. For Africans, the Cold War was not cold at all. It was quite hot in terms of atrocities that were perpetrated by groups funded and supported by the United States and to some extent, too, by the then Soviet Union.
Mm-hmm. As we end the hour, let
me commend what Moses is doing in terms of raising funds to support schools in Kenya and other places. But let me emphasize that what Africa needs, it's not so much foreign aid, because Africa has a lot of resources. What we need is to get African leaders to change their priorities so that, for example, Nigeria has enough money to educate all its children. There is no reason, for example, why the president will add an additional plane to the presidential fleet, which now makes it 11 aircrafts for the office of the presidency in Nigeria, where Boko Haram is operating. Only 8% of the girls go on from primary school to high school. 8%. So 92% of the girls who finish primary school in the northeastern part of Nigeria never get to high school. And to make matters worse, Boko Haram says it is opposed to Western education. The government, in a way, has allowed Boko Haram to triumph because the government has closed all schools in the three states in Nigeria that are badly affected by Boko Haram. So if Boko Haram says he doesn't want people to go to schools, it attacks schools, kills students, kills teachers, burns down the schools, and the government acquiesces to this by closing the schools, in effect, Boko Haram has been delivered victory on a platter of gold.
Let me go to Jay and Jim Morton, specifically in agriculture. What needs do you see in agriculture in Africa that are there to make Africa sustainable and self-sufficient?
Well, this is Jay. I absolutely agree with that remark that the government has to change their priorities. I mean, you know, in the 60s and 70s in the U.S., we saw a huge transition towards conservation tillage practices that have successfully improved sustainable production. But those were driven by incentives from the government. And, you know, we can try and we can give farmers things that we think will be profitable, but for really large scale change, the government has to be behind it and invested in it, and that's what we really see lacking where we're working in Kenya and Uganda.
Moses, do you see government leadership playing a part in what you're trying to do there in education?
Yes, I believe all the schools we work with are government schools, and we've seen that they, you know, they're the ones who have been marginalized, they're the ones who have been left behind politically with some of the things that Peter was talking about. And while I agree that this government, good government leadership is what we need, I also sometimes, you know, how much can I do to change that? It might be difficult. But what I can do is help educate, you know, the future generations of Africa to hopefully see this light of, we are not benefiting from our current systems. We need to find a better way, which ties into this good leadership when you're educated on the matters at hand and how we can actually bring our society forward.
Peter, will you leave us with some thoughts? We have less than a minute. What trends do you see for the future of Africa? Will the Africa today be essentially the same in 20 or 30 years?
Oh, no. Africa is going to be fundamentally different because the African people have made it very clear that they are not going to tolerate bad governance and poor leadership anymore. And with more Africans rising against poor governance and poor leadership, Africa will be able to put its priorities right. And once that happens, the giant in Africa will be awakened. As I mentioned earlier, Africa, it's a very, very rich continent. In fact, Ali Mazri has argued that Africa is the richest continent in the world. So the problem is how to use those resources for the benefit of Africans. And I think in 30 years, Africans will be able to use their resources for their own benefit.
Peter Agbese, native of Nigeria and professor of political science at the University of Northern Iowa. Thank you very much, Peter.
You're welcome, man.
Moses Bomet, founder and president of Hope for Africa, and Jay Norton, along with Jim Norton. Thank you for joining us this hour.
Thank you.
Thank you.
River to River is produced by Lindsay Moon and Emily Woodbury. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Tomorrow on the program, a news buzz edition you won't want to miss. We'll talk with John Dorshuk, Iowa's state archaeologist. We'll visit the new University of Iowa Mobile Museum. Lots more to come on our news buzz, River to River, tomorrow.